If you can, if you want, there are microphones on either side. If you want to step up and ask those, identify yourself.
Can I ask a question first? It's one of the benefits of being on a panel. To the attorneys, I'm interested in knowing if you can come up cite any particular case law that in which fair use actually trumps contracts. There's been some sort of argument over that. Where free speech trumps the terms of a contract? Is that
currently the case law that is developing is developing, for example, in the context of shrink wrap agreements or agreements associated with use of software? Generally speaking, the courts have found that the preemption doctrine in the Copyright Act was not intended, generally speaking, to interfere with contracts.
With any kind of contract.
And so, for the most part, the case law, it's the Procedee case by the Seventh Circuit and a number of other cases built along the same logic that have said that contracts can, in fact, limit what otherwise might be the limitations or exceptions to the rights of copyright owners under the Act.
I was wondering about this because in the field in which I work, which is visual culture quite a lot, you certainly see museums asking users to assert copyright in their names in the contract. The Met does this in a sort of clandestine way. You don't literally, when you put a caption under a Met photograph, say, copyright the Met, but you put courtesy the Met, and then in the contract you sign to get the image, you sign a contract that says that by signing the contract, you are asserting the Met's copyright in that image. I was just curious to know if that is a legitimate kind of contract.
That's a very interesting contract, which sounds, at least when applied to images which they know to be in the public domain, to be highly problematic and certainly not. I mean, saying something is copyrighted doesn't make it so, and in fact, would strike me as having all kinds of wonderful copyright misuse possibilities. I just want to respond a little bit, though, to your first question. I think it's a really difficult issue. I mean, obviously, we don't want to say there are rules of law like fair use, and you can't contract out of them, as Alan correctly said. There are lots of things that we, rights that we have, whether constitutional or statutory, which you can change by contract. I think that's true. I think the harder case, and there are cases which say this, even in the context of shrink wrap licenses, comes in a situation where it is effectively the state, a particular state of the United States, participating through its law in allowing somebody to change en masse, perhaps, the boundary lines that copyright law is supposed to set between fair use on the one hand and a protected expression on the other. This comes up particularly in things like preventing reverse engineering. Those are genuinely complicated issues. They're ones that the Procedee case is a very interesting take on them. It addresses some of them. It doesn't deal with others. So I think that one is one that I would expect there to be a lot more action on. It is one, however, that most of the people in this room would not deal with directly, because the cases in which it's most powerful are cases where you're dealing with copyrighted goods like software, which have strong network effects, where prohibiting somebody to decompile, let's say we decide to incorporate Microsoft in North Carolina, and North Carolina immediately passes a law which says you can write a shrink wrap contract which says you're not permitted to reverse engineer or decompile or copy or make anybody's stuff compatible with it. At that point, there would start to be a significant legal issue, I think.
Thank you.
Yes.
Does everybody on the panel, or all the lawyers, everybody, the three photographs that Jeff Dyer wanted the question is whether everybody agrees.
Charles Sims is asking whether everyone agrees that the photographs that Jeff Dyer wanted to use, the Diane Arbus photographs, were if he decided to use them, would that have been a case of fair use?
Great question. I feel I'm going to get some very
cheap without knowing the exact details. That's one where I would give more of Alan's answer. But let me give you one where I think that it might well have been a case of fair use. If he had written up the challenge that he made today, albeit using Janet Malcolm's words, to the control of the Arbus estate by Arbus relatives, and had illustrated particular attempts at control over meaning of objects with photographs, then I think there would be a very good claim for fair use, although if I were the lawyer of the university press, I might well be hitting my head and say, why did you ruin my day by bringing this in front of me? I think it would actually be a very good claim, because the claim is, my point is precisely that they won't give me permission. And that's a situation in which the denial of permission or the offering of permission at extortionate fees would really strengthen your hand. That, I think, would be a claim of fair use. We could get into the question of whether you needed three, and how big they needed to be. If the point is simply, I want to write a book about photography, and I really think the arbuses are important, and I want to use these, and I don't want to have to pay for them, I don't think you're going to find a lot of lawyers who say that is a clear fair use. If they're tiny thumbnails, that changes. So that's where I go with it. The details matter.
I had that problem with Diane Arbus for the magazine, and they wanted to use three pictures. And we sent it to Dune, and she wanted to look at the article, and she changed the article. She edited it all over the place. She says, if you make these changes, I'll let you use the photograph. At that point, I said, use one of the photographs, and tell the world why it was that she wouldn't give permission. Mm-hmm. And October Magazine comes back and forth, and they did a whole front piece about their problems, but they didn't use any of the photographs. But I thought they could use one in the context of having her censor or change the article as an effort to get permission. I thought that would be a fair use.
Leon, you realize this is the second instance you've told us about where a client ignored your advice.
has Arbus ever taken anyone? Has Dune Arbus ever taken any author to court?
I'd be surprised.
I doubt it.
I'd be surprised if it ever got that far, because everyone's too frightened.
A litigious reputation can be a great asset.
Yes.
A question from Wendy Lesser.
What I'm concerned about is the golden rule, the Mr. Adler book. That is the idea that you would only use material if you thought the person who had created it would be happy with your use. And that ruins criticism. I mean, there are a lot of criticism that's positive, but there's also a lot that's negative, and that's its function, to be negative. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's educational and why it's worth publishing. And so fair use cannot only include the uses that's going to make the artist happy if it's to have its function as criticism, it seems to me. I wonder if both Mr. Adler and Mr. Wells could comment on it.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was not my intention to say that approach, when people talk about a rule of thumb, obviously, to the extent that fair use serves a function of breathing room for freedom of expression, there will be those instances where its function is supposed to be based precisely on the notion that the specific use is one that's going to be disfavored for permission by the author, either because it's a use that ridicules or criticizes or comments in a way that the author will find negative. Nevertheless, even in that context, the idea that criticism, commentary, has never been considered to be per se, that the courts have felt the need to, or felt the ability to simply forego the full fair use analysis because the use is one of criticism or commentary, simply hasn't been the case. So, while the rule of thumb doesn't necessarily apply there, the question then becomes a separate one. Are there rules of thumb with respect to uses for criticism, parody, commentary, and things like that? And I think we're equally bereft of rules of thumb in that area as well.
If I could just follow up on that, I think that's absolutely right. Certainly the criticism point, I think that fundamentally undermines it. And even the asking the golden rule question, you run into all kinds of difficulties where you have artists with very different attitudes. Mark Hostler of Negative Lens asks himself that question. He'll get a very simple answer every time. Would I mind if anyone did this to me? Nope. He'll get that answer every single time.
And J.D. Salinger would give you the opposite.
The opposite answer every single time. Two comments that I think, or points that I think are maybe useful. The first one is, sometimes we really have situations where the values of copyright and the values of the First Amendment not even the First Amendment's stand-in within copyright, which is partly fair use and partly the idea expression distinction and some other rules, but the First Amendment itself come head-to-head. My favorite example is the situation in which Mein Kampf was published in the United States in a redacted edition, which took out some of that nasty anti-Semitism stuff. Not all of it, but some of it.
What year?
1937? Right before. Who was the senator?
Simpson.
Senator Simpson, not then a senator, published a full-length translation from the German of the original. A competing edition. You want to know what this guy really says? Here it is. This is a really interesting fair use case. It was a commercial publication. It was the whole thing. It certainly interfered with the market for the work. I think there was a really powerful First Amendment claim there. I don't know whether it would have won or not, but I think it was a really powerful First Amendment claim. Alan Cranston. So that's the first part. The second part is to say, this is the danger of the golden rule, just a minor anecdote which indicates how far the permissions culture have gone. I wrote an article called The Second Enclosure Movement, which quoted a poem from the 17th century, maybe the 18th century, about the enclosure of the common. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater villain loose who steals the common from under the goose. Nice little piece of rhyming agitprop. They were much terser in those days than we are now. Lower bandwidth. As a result, so I quote this, but of course, being a good academic, I have to, was it really Anon who published this, and when was it published? And so, you know, my poor research assistant is sent out to do battle with the archives. And what he does is he writes to every single person who has a provenance for this, either in a book or on the web, sends out about 25 emails. Of the 25 emails, 18 come back saying, "We're very sorry, we'll take it down now, please don't sue us." The poem is an anonymous poem published in 1723. Even Congress has yet to get to extending the copyright term that far. And it's about enclosure. So we write back going, we were asking where you found your provenance, that is to say, why you thought it came. We get back five follow-ups, of which my favorite was, "The reporter responsible has been disciplined." You want to talk about the permissions culture? There's the permissions culture in full flow. So that's the difficulty of the golden. Obviously, some people have a golden rule in their head that is very different than what anyone on this panel would imagine.
One more question, and I think we have to go. Yes.
One of the panelists talked about how one of the things that makes all this complicated is that you have different countries with their own set of laws. So I was wondering if you or other members of the panel could take a scenario take us through a scenario to give us a sense of that. So, for example, if something is written by Amos Oz in Israel, does he, you know, when he wants to protect it here, does he have to protect it, et cetera? Or I was thinking, I know a lot of software gets produced in Israel. How do they deal with, you know, moving from Israel to America, et cetera, et cetera?
You know,
it's a very complicated issue because, as you know, there are a number of international agreements. That beginning with the Berne Convention through the development of the WIPO copyright treaties and the TRIPS agreements. In some instances, exactly what kind of the nature of the rights and the way in which they can be enforced will depend upon whether or not a particular country is a signatory to those agreements or not. You're also going to have the situation that even if a country is a signatory, there tends to be the element of national treatment, which allows each of those countries, while affirming and implementing the basic principles of the international agreement, to nevertheless do so in their own sort of domestic manner. So it really is very hard to generalize in this area. I don't know if we can say much more.
So two quick answers. It is, of course, that copyright generally protected country by country. Under the rules of that country, constrained by international harmonization. Two problems. We've had massive international harmonization of copyright, both under the older Berne treatment, also under things like the TRIPS, the trade-related aspects of intellectual property. Unfortunately, when we talk about harmonization, those of you who are lovers of music will not understand, as lawyers do, that this is harmonization that only moves upward. So the protection only. So this is harmonization for sopranos, is the kind of harmonization that lawyers engage in. Higher rights, oh, I'll match that higher right. Oh, wait, your light is lower. You better put it up to match mine. Oh, now mine's lower than yours. So we're harmonizing, but we're getting higher. Unfortunately, in that process of harmonizing, we haven't been harmonizing the exceptions in copyright. That's kind of, we don't care about this. So we've been harmonizing the rights have been getting bigger, that puts more pressure on the exceptions, but we haven't been paying attention to that. That's maybe beginning to change within WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization. As for a real example, the Dead Sea Scrolls are copyrighted. No, I'm not joking. The person who recreated the Dead Sea Scrolls and was taking many, many years to reassemble them claimed a copyright in his assemblage of the fragments. Now, arguably, the work was of a different author, and about a different author. Nevertheless, arguably, it was completely functional, and at least to the extent that the translation and the reassembly was right, there was no originality, because it was right. That is to say, the only originality you could claim is if it was wrong, right? It's a crappy translation! It's mine! Nevertheless, an Israeli court said, oh yeah, absolutely, copyrighted, and helped to prevent the publication of a competing version by scholars who felt that this was being used as a professional sort of cartel to stop dissemination. That would not have happened in an American court. That's an example of differential application of different rules.
You also have to remember that this is all set in context. We've talked a lot here about freedom of expression. Most other countries of the world don't have freedom of the expression the way we at least aspire to it, even if we can't agree upon whether it actually exists in the United States. And that has to be considered as well.
Larry Lessig is now going to comment a bit about what we've been talking about.
So now I really am standing between you and lunch. So these two panels put together, I think, really emphasize the focus that I hope we increasingly take on this question. And that's the question. And the question here is, so what method might we adopt for resolving what I think we all see as a real problem, a real struggle? And one method might be, look to the subjective feelings of the people involved and try to make that work out well. And I'd really strongly first want to urge that that method just can't make sense of the way the system functions now. Because think about three different people who might be subjectively affected by various pieces of work. One would be, for example, the photographer, and we saw many examples this morning in the first panel, who might be subjectively affected by her work being reused in another form. A second person, as Joel Wachs made the point earlier this morning, might be the person whose picture was taken, who might say, I really object to the fact that, you know, my picture now has become a poster all across the world. And the third person who we might think about the subjective perspective from might be just an ordinary author of texts, right, who writes a book. Now, the law treats those three, or practices today, treats those three subjective experiences radically differently. Right? We take very seriously the artist. When the artist says, you know, this picture was taken, and it's really hurting me that it was taken, and therefore I want some kind of remedy. The person whose picture was taken, unless you're a movie star in California, basically has squat zero remedy against any use. You can be really upset, so what the law says? I'm sorry. In our society, we're allowed to take your picture, unless, you know, it's a really emotional period, your baby has just been run over or something, you know, awful things, that's an exception. And if you're the Terminator, that's an exception. But between those two places, you're just stuck. It's just the way the world is. And people like me who just write text, who are not talented enough to produce pictures, my work is misused all the time. My friend Joe Ito, a Japanese, talks about how in Japan, my work is used by people saying exactly the opposite thing, right? And this is a way of him saying that what I write is totally incomprehensible to anybody. Right? So the point is, and when that's used, if I stood up in a court and said, it's outrageous, they didn't call me up and ask for permission to use my work in the following six ways, and I want them to get I want an injunction against them doing that, the court would just laugh. It's ridiculous, right? So the point is, weirdly, sometimes we're really attentive to the subjective perspectives, and sometimes we're not. And so if subjective feelings is what matters, we don't really have a way to explain the cases. What I think we really need to think about, and this is the second panel really helped us do that, is what the consequences of a certain regime of protection will be for creativity. Because what will happen if we adopt a certain rule? And here's the Woods contribution I think was really valuable. I hadn't quite put it together until he got up on the panel that he was the Wood from that case. It's a very important case, Wood versus Universal. And I don't even know whether anybody in that case is aware of how radically that case and about two other cases changed the way film gets made. Right? Just changed the way film gets made. Now, you make film, and what happens is a gaggle of lawyers sit there and they produce literally 50 to 100 page books identifying every single thing that was seen in that film, and then little check boxes to see whether you've in fact cleared rights for all of those things. This is the preparation for errors in admission assurance. And you go through this process because the lawyers know that what will happen is if you haven't cleared everything, then 28 days after the film is released, which is what happens in the Woods case, some guy will go into court and try to get an injunction. If you've got a $100 million film out there and a court's going to stop it right at that minute, this is the point Judge Kaczynski was making this morning, it's pretty much worth $100 million to you to stop them from stopping you. So there's all the money in the world on the table for that person to take. So the practice now is a gaggle of lawyers are going to clear everything before you're going to be able to release the film. Well, if you're George Lucas, so what? You know, who cares? You know, he's got all the money in the world, right? And if you're a Hollywood filmmaker, you know, the major studios, so what? Who cares? They've got all the lawyers in the world. But if you're a documentary filmmaker, or if you're a filmmaker who wants to begin to produce things that can be distributed, you know, cheaply using DVD distribution, so what is it can't be, your film can't be made because the error in admissions insurance person would say, well, how did you clear this? I didn't clear this. I couldn't clear this. Okay, fine. I won't insure it. You can't distribute it. So the point is, this particular case, it might sound very compelling to feel like, oh, this is my work and it's been used like that. But if we recognize the rights in that way, it will have dramatic consequences for a whole bunch of other kinds of creativity that we ought to be worrying about. So my view is what we've got to think about is recognize everybody has an authentic subjective claim here, and you know, authentic in the sense they really do feel something. But if that's where we stop the analysis, then the unintended consequence of that method of working through these problems will be to stop all sorts of really important creative work. Instead, we've got to think about what the systemic consequences of a particular way of protecting rights is. And the systemic consequences increasingly, I think in the context of film in particular, we'll see this in the afternoon panel, is that it makes the cost of producing this creativity so high that a whole bunch of creators just can no longer participate in the legitimate market of creativity. Thanks.
Thank you to the whole panel. Thank you to all of you for being here. We'll take a lunch break now. For panelists and Institute fellows, we do have lunch for you in the next room. The rest of you, got a beautiful day. Get back here at 2:30. We're going to have some great films by 10-year-olds criminals at 2:30.